From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. This evening, it's a great pleasure and privilege to welcome Mohamed Fahmy, the formerly jailed Canadian-Egyptian journalist, currently a visiting fellow at the Maurice Young Center for Applied Ethics at UBC, and an adjunct professor at the UBC Graduate School of Journalism. Greetings, Mohamed. It's wonderful to see you.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be part of the UBC family after this horrific ordeal that I've been through. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Our pleasure. But I know your journey to UBC has certainly been difficult, but I'm curious, during your detention, did the idea of joining a university ever occur to you?
Well, I was very happy to see that UBC took a stand from day one and published a statement against what I was going through. So that was uplifting. And then it was another very good feeling when I was approached by Mr. Peter Klein, who expressed his interest in bringing me over here. And of course, at the time, you try to use escapism and, to be positive and think of the future and what you want to do. And I could easily see myself on the campus here. Yet it was always something in the back of my mind because I had the case to deal with first. But then when I got my freedom and I signed on and I came here, it's just like it's a dream come true in every sense of the word.
Well, that's excellent. But now that you're here, how do you find the climate? So, I mean, intellectually and politically. Do you think the students that you've met so far are as well informed as perhaps students in other parts of the world?
I think they're more informed than many of the students I've met in several universities that I've attended, and especially on issues related to my case as well. I was completely shocked and baffled and humbled and excited to see that so many students were coming up to me and giving me hugs and asking me for information on the case and Egypt and whatnot. And even from the time we got on the flight here, me and my wife, we had police officers at the airport being extremely nice and asking for selfies and cab drivers. So it's just such a warm feeling to be here and to be welcomed at home. And my wife, especially, that hasn't never been to Canada, is also feeling very comfortable here.
Excellent. But let's back up a little bit. How did you get drawn to journalism? I understand, or I think, you were studying business at one point.
That is correct. I was studying business, but I had this hobby of writing and creative writing, and I continued to indulge in freelance writing and opinion pieces, and my father was also into writing. So I believe I just felt that that was my passion. And I got my first job in 2003, and I entered Iraq on the first day of the war. And that was a crash course, a schooling, right there and then. You're on the front line with the Los Angeles Times, one of the most prominent newspapers, as an assistant reporter, a translator, interpreter. And gradually I started writing my own pieces, and I started doing radio pieces from the ground in Iraq because, not too many journalists had that privilege of being there right from the first day, and I stayed there for a whole year. And I think this is when I became addicted to this very beautiful craft. And I think it also stems from my own passion for adventure and helping others and uncovering the truth and having that eye for the investigative eye, to never take anything for what it stands for and just, dig in even more. And then it was one big story from then on. I don't think I took a real break from 2003 until I went
came
back
to UBC.
Pardon
me,
prison. Yeah, exactly, until I got here.
Well, really, it's interesting you mentioned that because it sounds a little naive, but how did you spend your time in prison? I mean, were you permitted to write? Clearly, you had discipline, a structure, a kind of very ordered life that wasn't your own. What happened? What did you do? And I know you were in two periods of incarceration.
Well, in the beginning, it was shocking to be placed in a terrorism wing with Mohammed al-Zawahiri, the brother of the Al-Qaeda leader, and ISIS fighters and extremists who have no respect to humanity or journalism or anything that we live for. And I didn't think the ordeal was going to take that long. So I took it a bit in a positive way, and I continued to interview these people inside the prison. And it was like a lifelong exclusive. And I actually started a radio mock show where every night at 8 o'clock, and I called it the Al Jazeera live show, I asked all the prisoners to go up to this hatch that we had on our door, which was our only window into the corridor, where there was 20 cells. And I dealt with it like the radio show we're having right now. I interviewed the extremists about their time in Syria and Libya, and the Muslim Brotherhood senior members were in there who were working with the president at the time when he was ousted. So that's how I got through my day. And after a while, the show became such an important part of everyone's life in that wing. And I think I would not have been able to deal with it the same way unless I had that radio show going.
So essentially, though, they're speaking into the corridor.
Yeah, they're speaking into the corridor. I could only see, hear their voices, but I couldn't see their faces. So it was very challenging, but we could hear each other very clearly. And at one point, the warden of the prison came up to me and said, "Mohammed, you got to stop that radio show. I don't want it to go on." And I was like, "So you are silencing me again and taking me off the air while I'm in prison? Come on!"
This is pretty remarkable. That's really something. But were you, in fact, able also to write? I mean, did you have paper?
I took notes. Yeah,
But they allowed you, though.
No, they didn't. My wife was my lifeline. She smuggled paper into me. She smuggled a pen into me during the family visits. She was also smuggling, my notes outside, because I was taking a lot of notes. And I am incorporating them into the book that I'm writing now about this ordeal. And I really, really value these notes because it's information from people who are influence the Middle East today. And they are this whole situation is a mirror image of where the Middle East stands today, where you are in this prison with seculars, extremists, moderate Islamists, students, and journalists.
This is pretty astonishing that you were permitted, or the danger, I should say, that certainly your wife must have experienced in being the messenger in and out. That's an awfully dramatic situation. And did that continue the second time? I mean, you were out on bail, and then, of course, you were retried and then sentenced for 3 years. Were you able to continue the radio show or the writing or the transfer knowledge?
No, I didn't. I was placed in a very separated from these Islamists. It was just me and my colleague, Baher, because I was so outspoken against the Islamists and the extremists when I was released on bail. So it was a threat to my life to be placed with them. I just spent another very tough 28 days because you've already tasted freedom. And you were promised so many times that you were going to be deported to Canada and that you were going to be free. And I had so many plans. I was even supposed to be here in UBC a month before the time of my actual arrival now. So it was extremely hard to go back.
Was the pardon a shock when it happened?
It was a shock when it happened. And I think it was a collective effort that finally the Egyptian president had enough of this guy. Thanks to you and the university and the journalists who were, unified behind our cause more than anything I've ever seen before.
That's wonderful. But I know not a lot of time has passed since, of course, your release, but I want to know what has been the impact on your understanding or vision of journalism. Has it changed at all? Has it reignited something deep within you that this is critical and everyone must continue this sort of effort to find the truth, even in very, very difficult, dangerous circumstances? Or have you said, that's a pretty high price to pay?
If I ever believed in journalism, now I am 10 times more engaged with what this very honorable job means. It's a way of life, and in that solitary confinement cell for 1 month where I had no access to light or way of telling time and insects and had a broken shoulder and sleeping on the floor, the journalism outside that was happening and the way the support that I was getting and the people, all the journalists that were supporting us, is what kept me going. And being on this side of the microphone made it very clear what we stand for as journalists, that, you are keeping my story alive. It wasn't just about me anymore. It was a bigger cause about what the meaning of journalism is and the fight for freedom of expression, and it inspired me beyond my imagination would ever have taken me. And this is why I started the Fahmy Foundation here in Vancouver with my lawyers, and I registered it while I was in prison. And, I feel very strongly about it, and I'm engaged with many of the families and the lawyers of the people I'm fighting for now, the journalists behind bars. There's 200 at the moment across the globe, and 65 have been killed this year already. So what is that about?
What's the role of citizen journalism in all of this? Do you see it as a valuable addition to the kind of pursuit you're describing, or is it a distraction? And I've heard many arguments, pro and con, about citizen journalism.
You've hit the spot here. A lot of the problems I'm suffering in this case is because of citizen journalism. There were several Muslim Brotherhood sympathizers that were students, that were bundled in the case, and because they were doing citizen journalism in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood. And they were selling some of the footage to Al Jazeera. Now, the judge refused to separate between me, the journalist, and the activist who were indulging in journalism. And that is a huge argument. I am, of course, supportive of citizen journalism, and I think it's important that the spectrum is more open to citizen journalism, but I think there has to be a better way of defining it and working with it so that both the journalists and the networks are not endangered. And right now, we are, journalists across the world, are targeted by both governments and by extremists. There's no neutral place to go. So citizen journalism is important, yet I think there needs to be more clarity on who should be able to send in the footage. Most networks, and I've worked in major networks, have it very clear that if you are part of a political group or if you are part of a certain opposition group or stand for any specific group, then you shouldn't be dealing with us as a network. Yeah, but some networks, unfortunately, have broken this ethic.
What about social media? Do you feel that A was critical in terms of your cause, your case? And do you have a slightly broader view of the value of social media, apropos the citizen journalism and the kind of, I don't want to call them mistakes, but wrong directions it sometimes can go?
Well, the social media grassroots campaign that is part of the reason why I'm having this conversation with you right now, it helped a lot in keeping our plight alive, and a lot of the organizations in Egypt were citing many of the movements and the statements that were on the social media. I do believe social media, I witnessed it in my own eyes during the revolution in Egypt in 2011 and other conflicts on the ground where the social media had become the most preferred voice on the ground, especially that a lot of these activists and people who were indulging in social media were getting access that journalists were not able to do. So, of course, social media is very, very important. And I'm seeing a trend now that worries me a little bit in Egypt and other countries where they are now targeting citizens by stating it very clearly in these new terrorism laws that if you're using social media and you happen to report something that does not conform with the government's line, you may be liable to prosecution. So it's tough.
It's dangerous.
Very.
It's dangerous. It's dangerous. So tell me three things that you would share with journalism students today here at UBC. Three points. What would they be?
Well, three points that I feel strongly about. One, that I do believe that freedom of expression and free speech is not just the responsibilities of governments, but it's also the responsibilities of media networks and organizations, and that whatever job you take on, you have to be very clear in your ideas and your expectations from your employer and get it in writing. Because I do have issues with my former employer, Al Jazeera, as you may have noticed. Also, I do believe that what helped me a lot throughout this ordeal is that every single person I worked with since I started as an interpreter or as an assistant reporter or as an editor, that genuine approach you have in your job will then come back and work for you when all these people vouch for you in the future. So your reputation from day one on the job will come through for you 50 years later. I guarantee you on many levels. And the third one is the fact that if you're getting into this business because you have that feel for adventure and seeking the truth the way I did, if you think, you know, you could be the best journalist in the world, but you also need to understand how to operate in hostile environments on the ground and be able to maneuver using the language skill and the social skills and having that sort of professional training in dealing with hostile environments so that you can perform your job freely and safely.
Do you wish to go back to the front line, however you describe it, to return to the front line of journalism? I know you're happy here. I know you and your wife are thrilled to be in Canada, in Vancouver, at UBC. But is there something tugging at you?
Well, not at that specific moment. I know myself, and I'm going to get that bug again. And I am. It's very hard for me to, you know, isolate myself from the news. But I do need to recuperate here and gather myself. And UBC is the best transitional phase for that. I'm learning from the students here all over campus, and I hope that I can add more knowledge reflecting on what I've been through. But I have issues to deal with here as well. I'd like my wife to get her Canadian passport and immigration documents in place. I have a permanent disability in my arm. I can't raise my shoulder more than 90 degrees because of an injury that was exacerbated in prison. So I need to also fix my arm, or at least improve the range of motion. So I think it'll take like a year maybe before I can do frontline journalism again, because it does take a lot of your physical energy as well.
Wow. Well, I'm no doubt that it does. And psychological energy.
Yes.
Same
sure.
time.
Sure.
Do you think, though, now that you have stepped away from it, we'll say for the short term, there are certain expectations of you now that you're in Canada, that people are anticipating that you are going to become a certain kind of voice or a certain kind of figure? It strikes me that that is a possibility, and it might, in a sense, curb your own desires and certain things that you want to pursue, or not really. You feel that it's still pretty open in terms of what you could do.
No, I have positioned myself that way. I feel that it's my responsibility to make things happen at a better pace. For example, I am working now on a charter with Amnesty International in Ottawa and my lawyers to present it to Mr. Justin Trudeau, our new Prime Minister, and I spoke to him about that in our one-hour meeting before elections to explain what we can do to better protect Canadian prisoners abroad. And this stems from my own experience, and it also involves revisiting specific laws and approaches of the consular services so that no one should have to go through a lot of the issues that happened to me. And again, I feel that I have this platform now and this momentum going for me, and I'm speaking in Paris and the World Democracy Forum, and I'm speaking in New York and other speaking engagements, and I can use that platform to speak for others and, you know, highlight issues of press freedoms, which are probably the worst in decades all over the world.
Yeah, I think it's critical the story be told, and to as many people as possible, from every, what cliche shall I use, walk of life. So I want to close by asking you this question. It might be a touch odd. If you were going to spend part of this year at UBC, or the time at UBC, writing your autobiography, where would it start?
It would start by immigrating to Canada in the 90s with my family. When we were in Kuwait and Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and we felt, again, my dad was a writer and he wasn't allowed into Egypt for 8 years because he was writing against the tyranny of the government back then. So we came to Canada looking for human rights, true press freedoms, true respect to civil liberties. And I think that's where it would start, because these are the values that I picked up and respected and lived for with and during my education here and college years and the little work that I did here. And that's what I took back to the Middle East, and it helped me to be, you know, both an Egyptian and a Canadian, in that I value and I'm proud to be a Canadian, proud to be an Egyptian. It helped in my reporting to have my feet grounded on both sides of the world and being able to maneuver, you know, safely, and reflected on my own reporting. So I think it would start by me landing here in the land of the three and just living that beautiful dream.
How old were you?
I think I was 19 or 18. Yeah, I think I was 18, and now
just
40.
Right on the cusp, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's
a great age, exactly.
To learn about hockey and other things.
Yeah,
right?
I just went to the hockey game this week, the Canucks in Montreal, and I was like a little kid, and I was so happy. I haven't felt that comfortable and relaxed for the past 2 years. I'm sleeping better now. I haven't slept well in 2 years. I was sleeping 3-4 hours a day back in Egypt and in prison, and now I'm sleeping my good 8-9 hours.
And watching hockey.
And watching hockey and TV, and I'm just happy all the time. We're like little kids, me and my wife now.
That is really fantastic.
Jumping around.
I'm so delighted you were able to come in and talk to us today. So many thanks to Mohamed Fahmy, currently in residence at the UBC School of Journalism and visiting fellow at the Young Center for Applied Ethics at UBC. It's really been a great pleasure. And stay tuned for future conversations with faculty and students of the always engaging UBC Faculty of Arts. Mohamed, thank you so much again.
My pleasure. Thank you.